In the COVID-19 era, food supply is at risk, but the reasons why are surprising.
If we have stuff that's in the field that they are not harvesting because they don't have a market for it, it's cheaper to leave it in the field.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, April 14th, a look at food supply and how farmers and farm workers are handling the pandemic. Also, a look at how COVID-19 has affected local news media and what it means for coverage of the illness.
All news organizations are in trouble right now, and it looks very bad. My inbox is full every day, every morning when I wake up, and I empty it by the end of the day, and it's mostly tips about layoffs, closures, pay cuts, and furloughs.
Then we speak with a scientist who used social media to track down the spread of COVID-19 in China back in December. There was a lot of news on Monday and a lot of talk from politicians about who has the authority to open up the economy, including our president, who said this during a pretty dramatic press conference.
When somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total.
Of course, that is not the case. The legislature and judiciary check the president's power. And in this instance, the governors may decide. Yesterday, a number of governors came together to announce that their states will be working together on the next phase of their coronavirus responses.
We just sent out a joint statement of a shared vision for a process and protocol, a framework for reopening.
But reopening with a plan and a smart plan, because if you do it wrong, it can backfire.
Meanwhile, Senator Bernie Sanders had a non-coronavirus update of his own, speaking here to Joe Biden.
So today I am asking all Americans, I'm asking every Democrat, I'm asking every Independent, I'm asking a lot of Republicans to support your candidacy, which I endorse.
But we're going to leave all of that to the side for now and step far away from Washington or any state capital. We'll begin today by looking instead at some of the people keeping the country fed during this health crisis, farmers and farm workers. The coronavirus outbreak has been incredibly disruptive to the food industry. Under normal circumstances, most of us in the U.S. split our budgets pretty evenly between the food we consume at home and the food we eat when we go out. But that's changing, with stay-at-home orders and restrictions on non-essential businesses. But farms around the country are still producing plenty of product. Only now, there are fewer places to sell it, with restaurants closed or scaled back. And that leaves farmers to figure out how to sell their product to stay afloat, and leaves people around the country who can't get their hands on that food scrambling for solutions. And all of this comes after months of uncertainty for farmers around trade policy. Joe Del Bosque is the president of a roughly 2,000-acre farm in Central California, where he grows a number of crops, including melons and asparagus.
Asparagus is something that is eaten a lot in restaurants. And so we're seeing a softness in demand there. And I'm hearing from colleagues over in the other parts of the vegetable sector that are feeling this also. The loss of what they call the food service sector is really impacting the vegetable and fresh produce industry.
And Becca Jablonski also joined us. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics at Colorado State University. Becca told me how the food industry is adjusting to our rapidly shifting economy.
Restaurants are pretty much shut down, although some have transitioned to doing online ordering. Schools have been shut down, although some have transitioned to doing emergency food feeding programs, or they're partnering with food banks to do this. So we have closures of some restaurants and other kinds of markets, but at the same time, we see growth in sales in other types of venues. So for example, we've heard from a number of grocery stores that sales were up 30% in March of 2020 compared to March of 2019. So with some colleagues, we put together an economic impact assessment on what we're projecting in losses based on lost sales from farm selling to restaurants, schools, some of the direct markets. So, for example, in some places across the country, we have winter farmers markets that were shut down during the month of March. Of course, many of them are now pivoting and trying to implement social distancing measures. So we estimate that the economic impact is about $1.32 billion from March to May in farm losses. So that wouldn't include some of other losses. But actually, you know, especially with some of what's coming out, I think that we probably underestimated the total impact because we were not necessarily accounting for some of the major losses that are occurring, not necessarily in places where farms are selling direct to some of these markets.
Well, Joe, have you seen that hit you yet? Have you had to lay off any workers or change the way you work as a result of this change in demand?
Well, luckily, we're just at the beginning of our season. We actually started harvesting asparagus a few weeks ago, but it's been very slow because of the cool weather. But this week, we're going to crank up more, and we'll see about that. Now, our asparagus is organic, and it's not likely to be impacted as much by the markets in the food service, because restaurants and schools typically don't serve organic asparagus. Most of ours goes directly to retailers. But eventually, you know, the other asparagus, the conventional, if it is feeling an impact from the food service sector, their price could get dragged down and they could pull me down also.
In terms of your workers, what are you doing right now to keep them safe and healthy?
Well, we've implemented a lot of protocols with our workers. You know, in the past, we've had very good food safety protocols that we learned over the years. These include things like a lot of hand washing, don't show up to work when you're sick. If you sneeze, sneeze in your elbow. What we're implementing now is now things like social distancing, which we didn't do before, because before we were concerned with transmitting pathogens to the consumer through the food. Now we're concerned with transmitting pathogens to each other. And so we're implementing other things, also things like sanitizing. Our supervisors have a bottle of sanitizing solution that they sanitize anything that the employees touch, like bathroom doors and so forth.
If workers take time off for being sick, are they still getting paid?
We do have a sick day program, but they do need to qualify for it. In other words, if you show up to work today for the first time, you can't get a sick day tomorrow. You have to be in work for a specified period that is in line with the regulations of the state of California. So we haven't lost anybody yet so far, thank God.
Yeah.
Everybody's been healthy and everybody's aware of what's going on. We talk to them and try to keep them informed, because we're learning every day. You know, this is totally new to us, so we're trying to learn as much as we can about the virus and how to prevent our workers from contracting it.
Becca, when we think about this sort of shifting demand and where food is going versus where it's needed, are producers able to pivot and say, sell things direct to consumers? Is that difficult if you already have these sort of set up supply chains between, say, a producer and a school or a restaurant or a wholesaler? How easy is it to be nimble?
So I think for some producers, it's easier than others. And at least from what I'm seeing, you know, I think those small and mid-scale farms are really in a sweet spot, right? That they just are able to pivot in a way much more easily than I think some of the larger scale growers. And if you are already selling direct to consumers, or you had a relationship with some wholesalers, maybe where there was one step in the supply chain before the consumer, we've seen some producers do some really innovative things. So for example, I've heard from a number of the small and mid-scale growers in Colorado that what they're seeing now in terms of sales, so what they usually have in sales over a month, they're able to do in 1 week, you know, assuming that they have the product available.
Joe, when you are thinking about where you're going to sell, do you know that already? Do you have flexibility built into finding new buyers or figuring out where your product can go?
Well, I think there's been a trend in the fresh produce industry of changing the way we market our products. I guess I would be considered a larger producer, even though I don't consider myself that. But the success in the fresh produce industry is to take as much risk out of the market as you can. And what is being done is producers are actually contracting with either wholesale or retail customers. We do the same thing. We want to take out the the high fluctuations of the market. So we actually contract with retailers. I'm a big provider for Whole Foods, for instance, and we are planting right now to their orders for July, August, and September. And so that same thing happens in a lot of the produce industry. And so there are a lot of producers that contract with food service for providing, say, chopped lettuces for restaurants or schools or so forth. They have a program for that. And it's not so easy to change that once you've planted for them, and we're planting for a market contract that we got 3 months from now. So it's not easy for us to be as nimble as maybe a smaller farmer.
Would you say, you know, donate any of your food to food banks if it got to that point, if you didn't have the kind of buyers lined up that you're expecting?
I think most farmers would say if you have some product and it's already been harvested and packed, and you have nowhere to go with it, yes, that is done. And we've done that before in the past. If we have stuff that's in the field, and, you know, and there are farmers who are in that situation now, that they are not harvesting because they don't have a market for it, it's cheaper to leave it in the field than to pick it and pack it and put all the expense in it to send it off to someplace where you'll get nothing back.
I think that image is very hard for people to wrestle with, because the idea of unused food on the one hand, and yet lines, like we've seen lines of cars for food banks. Why is it so hard, Becca, to bridge the gap between producers who have product and people who need food?
So our emergency food system is not equipped to deal with the number of people that we have accessing it currently. So, you know, one of the big bottlenecks has been storage capacity, right? Especially for fresh produce, like Joe's talking about, right? You need to have refrigeration available, places to store that product. And with the quantities they're talking about right now, you know, a lot of times that's really challenging. I've been working with the National Farm to School Network. They run and support many of the farm to school programs across the country. And we talked to them about how the school was adapting to provide these meals to children. I mean, many of the kids in our country are dependent on these school meals. And what we heard is that as they're transitioning to these different types of emergency food programs, they're really shifting away from providing fresh or perishable product and towards non-perishable items. And that makes it more challenging to connect producers directly to those types of networks and feeding systems.
Joe, do you worry about the long-term impact for your own operation and for other growers around you in California as this drags on?
Yes, we're thinking of what the future holds for us. The fresh fruit and vegetable industry is probably most impacted because we don't have as much flexibility as, say, the non-perishable foods. You know, if I grew beans or rice, you could just hold it in a silo, right? But you can't hold my melons very long. We can hold them in the cold room for a few days or maybe even a week, but eventually that cold room gets full and you have to make room for the new fruit coming in. This would be very difficult for us if this continues much longer.
Joe Del Bosque is the president of Del Bosque Farms in Central California, and Becca Jablonski is an assistant professor at Colorado State University. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, NPR reported that to provide relief to the agriculture industry, the Trump administration is considering cutting the wages of migrant farm workers who travel to the U.S. for work. This comes after President Trump instructed the Department of Agriculture to provide at least $16 billion to farm owners. There are more than 2 million farm workers in the U.S. who are considered essential workers amidst the global pandemic and economic crisis. But as COVID-19 cases continue to rise, farm workers around the country are worried for their own health and safety as they continue to harvest the food we eat. Here to tell us more, I'm joined by Baldomar Velasquez, a longtime farm worker organizer and founder of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee with the AFL-CIO. Hi, Baldomar.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by Edgar Franks, political director with the independent union Familias Unidas por la Justicia in Washington State. Edgar, it's nice to have you on.
Hi.
Edgar, can you start by describing working conditions for farm workers?
Well, here in Washington State, most of the work is done right now. It's row by row. People are almost shoulder to shoulder while they're preparing the harvest for the summer, whether it be raspberries or blueberries or strawberries. Even in our case, in our county, there's a huge tulip harvest. So there's the conditions are cramped. People are really close to each other. Apart from that, the treatment is harsh sometimes by supervisors and management and the company. Levels of poverty are high among farm workers, and exposure to pesticides has also been a generational issue that hasn't been solved yet. So the right now with what's happening with COVID just amplifies the necessity for passing legislation or some kind of relief for farm worker families who are putting their lives on the line.
And what about living conditions for a lot of these workers?
So here in Washington State, we have kind of a mix of workers. There's an H-2A population that lives mostly in eastern Washington.
Those are temporary working visas.
Yes, under the federal program. But basically, the living conditions are also very cramped. If you're living in an H-2A labor camp, you can have 8-10 people living in the same room, cooking together, sharing the bathrooms. Also in the summer when the migrant camps open up, it's the same conditions. Labor camps have been notorious for not being updated since almost World War II. So communal showers, communal kitchens, cramped living conditions. The conditions for farm workers have been harsh, whether it be working or living conditions.
Baldemar, obviously no single farm looks exactly the same, but can you give us a sense of how, say, a smaller family-owned farm and a big corporate operation compare, and I guess the labor conditions at each?
Well, I think Edgar describes it pretty clearly across the entire United States. There is a distinction between large corporate farms and small family farms. Small family farms are less able to make accommodations like the corporate farms might be able to adjust to the conditions and preparation. I mean, no farmer wants his workforce sick and closed down. He needs the workforce. He needs to keep them healthy. Now, some pay more attention than others. Some are able to pay more attention than others. And I think that this is where we come in as an organization, where we have to find the collective response to this. And I think that underscores the need for why unions have been so necessary in this country. Because if the workers don't have a collective way to respond to this, it's going to be much harder to address the individual cases from farm to farm. Where there is no union, there is no protection, no collective voice, and they're left to the whims or the ability to make decisions to the owner, to the supervisors, to make the accommodations for social distancing in the workplace and how you carry out the work.
What have you heard from members of your union about the conditions they're under right now and the danger of the pandemic spreading? If we're talking about close working, close living, you know, that those are not exactly socially distant conditioned.
Yes, we have about around 4,000 members in the country now. There'll be close to 10,000 by the middle of July. And what we're hearing from workers now, I mean, we've been communicating with them from Mexico before they come in. We have an office in Monterrey that keeps close touch with the members. So we're able to advise them as to the processing of their visas in Monterrey and their transportation into the United States to try to deliver some protocols that they can watch and spread the word to their neighbor workers that they come with. We have had reports of a few cases already on some non-union farms. On the union farms, of which there are some 650 in North Carolina, Virginia, and I think Tennessee, were able to dialogue with the farmers to insist on the accommodations if they don't have them available. But I want to say that many of them are doing their best to make the adjustments under the current oppressive economic conditions that they face from manufacturers, retailers, and large corporations that that they supply.
Edgar, what types of resources are available for workers in order to keep them from getting sick? Do they have access to adequate supplies and, you know, protective equipment?
Unfortunately, no. Even in Washington State, where our governor has done a relatively good job of lowering the curve, lots of those protective measures haven't reached the fields. Whether it be the mask or even some hand washing stations, basic things like that, have not reached the workers. The testing has also been lacking, especially since our community lives in a more rural setting. Not much attention has been paid to the rural communities during the pandemic.
Edgar, the season is starting to pick up in the coming weeks and months, but the Trump administration is proposing lowering the wages for farm workers who come in on an H-2A visa. What does that mean for farm workers in Washington State, where you are, and around the U.S.?
We considered that a big disrespect. We see that the people that are being targeted for this are the H-2A workers, who are also putting their lives on the line. And farm work has always been considered one of the most dangerous jobs in the country. And to lower the wages of folks that are leaving their home country, sacrificing their time with their family, their own health, their well-being, for the agricultural industry, I mean, farm work wages have been historically low compared to the general population, and to now at a time of crisis to take advantage of the crisis to propose lowering wages to H-2A workers sets a bad example, because we know that that'll trickle down to other domestic farm workers or migrant farm workers. So we think that the Trump administration has been using this political moment to push more right-wing economic policies. So we definitely will fight for raising wages across all work.
Baldemar, these are pretty coveted visas, these H-2A visas. I wonder, do any of the workers you all are in touch with in, say, your office in Mexico, are they having second thoughts about coming, given COVID-19?
There's a huge concern, but the bigger concern is feeding their families.
Yeah.
And so they feel like they have to do it. And they're being more attentive to the protective measures they need to carry out to protect themselves and their co-workers. All the more reason why our country has to respond to facilitating protecting this vulnerable population. I think that we have to not pursue and call out the government right now of its duplicity, pushing a precedent of a double standard going back to the 1950s. When agricultural workers had a different minimum wage from the rest of the nation, and they had the fallback of the old Bracero program, which was ended for its known cruelty to workers. We can't go back to those days. And we, as Edgar was saying, we need to fight this with everything we can and call out this administration for that regressive proposal.
Edgar, do you feel like you are getting traction in your efforts to organize right now during this pandemic? After all, Congress is still working. You mentioned the Washington State governor. Are they listening to you?
There's almost an anger that's been growing among workers about how disrespectful everything has been towards farm workers, whether it be the lack of protective personal equipment, no hazard pay, being left out of the economic stimulus package. And workers are now have been reaching out to us more than they have in the prior years. And I think they're looking into unions as the solution to the problem. But in the meanwhile, we have to continue to work in the fields and work organizing the workers.
Edgar Franks is political director with Familias Unidas por la Justicia in Washington State. And Baldemar Velasquez is a longtime farm worker organizer and founder of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee with the AFL-CIO. Thank you so much to both of you.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
The news industry has been struggling to stay afloat for years, and with the coronavirus pandemic, it may have been dealt a critical blow. In the past month, there's been a flood of layoffs, furloughs, and closures in newsrooms across the U.S. Almost every part of the journalism industry has been affected. Small and large newspapers, digital and print outlets, mainstream and alternative press. For more on this and why it matters now, we're joined by Kristen Hare, a reporter covering local news for Pointer, a nonprofit that trains, covers, and supports journalism around the world, and Victoria Vilk, the program director of digital safety and free expression at the nonprofit PEN America, and who co-authored a report late last year on the decimation of local news. I asked Kristen about the immediate impacts we've been seeing in the journalism world.
All news organizations are in trouble right now, and it looks very bad. My inbox is full every day, every morning when I wake up, and I empty it by the end of the day, and it's mostly tips about layoffs, closures, pay cuts, and furloughs, which have hit the whole news industry. It's worse, I think, for local newspapers. These are places that had pre-existing conditions as they tried for the last decade to move from advertising supported to reader and member subscriber supported. They've been hit the hardest, but you know, Tegna stations around the country have implemented furloughs. And we're even starting to see radio stations around the country where lots of people get their news in the sort of short updates that come with music. They are also being hit really hard right now.
Are there any beats that are particularly affected more than others, or is this across the board?
It's across the board. There are places that are moving their sports reporters over to be covering the coronavirus. I have heard of features reporters, you know, entertainment, music, food, those places getting hit in some places harder than others. But lots of newsrooms, I think, are trying to preserve the boots on the ground, even if that ground is in their homes right now, and keeping as many reporters as possible available to cover this story. Also, this is a story that affects every beat that every journalist covers right, in one way or another. And so we need more than just the number of stories. We need the stories about the restaurant owners and the places and the people that we care about as a community.
Victoria, can you walk us through kind of the state of the news industry before this pandemic? It was not particularly rosy.
No, you know, unfortunately, local journalism has been in decline. And effectively, the business model for for-profit local journalism has collapsed. So watchdog reporting, beat reporting, everyday reporting is costly to produce. Historically, that has been subsidized primarily by ad revenue. But with the rise of the internet and the growth of tech giants like Google and Facebook, they've been siphoning the majority of the ad revenue that used to go to local news outlets away. So in local markets, it's something like 70% of ad revenue now goes to Google and Facebook. And so what's happened is newspapers in particular, as Kristen said, have been hit the hardest. They've lost over $35 billion in ad revenue and nearly 50% of staff in the past 15 years before the pandemic hit. Over 2,000 newspapers closed, over 1,000 more are ghost papers. And the reason that matters is that if you think of local news as an ecosystem, newspapers are still providing over 60% of original reporting at the local level. So when you lose newspapers, you know, whether they're print or digital, you're leaving millions of Americans without trusted sources of local information.
When we think about what is currently happening, are local businesses, say, buying ads, you know, in the online or even print edition of their local paper, or are they holding back right now as well?
Even though ad revenue is already in decline, there are still, of course, it's still a major part of how newspapers and other news outlets make their money. And so a lot of businesses are struggling themselves because they've either had to shut down or, you know, put a hold on things so that they're not spending money on advertising the way they used to. A lot of businesses have actually said that they don't want their ads to appear next to anything related to the pandemic or to death or to destruction, right? Most stories right now on the news out of necessity are about this crisis. So they don't want, you know, their ads to appear in that way. And then on top of that, you know, we were really impressed at the degree to which local news outlets have been attempting in the last 15 years to innovate and adapt their way out of this collapsing business model. So they've been finding new revenue streams like events, like reader revenue. All of those things are now threatened across the board. So even the outlets that have done the very best job diversifying their revenue streams are faced with really severe economic impact.
Well, I'm also curious, you know, we've been talking about local organizations, but journalism, of course, is also filled with freelance workers who work outside the protection of, you know, an employee-employer relationship, but often file copy or file radio spots for the organizations that you're mentioning. Kristen, what do we know about what's happening to freelancers?
I think we should assume that it's 10 times worse or more than what local newsrooms are dealing with, that people who, you know, have relationships with local newsrooms who count on them to pay their invoices on time. I have seen, you know, tweets from journalists reporting that they won't be getting paid for work that they've already done because of the way the pay schedule works. These people are part of an ecosystem. And when that ecosystem collapses, it hurts everyone, including freelancers.
Are we seeing impacts maybe on the quality of coverage? If, say, you've only got a few reporters who are being forced in as much as they can to work from home, are local audiences getting the kind of high quality news that could help them make decisions in a really scary time?
The short answer is it would be impossible for local news outlets to be in the financial state that they're in right now and not have it impact the kind of coverage. We have been enormously touched and impressed by the degree to which local outlets across the country have risen to the challenge. But the problem is that we already know that before this crisis hit, there have been study after study that shows that when local journalism declines, government costs go up, government corruption increases, local officials conduct themselves with less integrity and efficiency. We know that civic engagement is deeply impacted by local journalism, so fewer people go out to vote and they don't know what their candidate is or what the platform that their candidate stands for. When you lose local journalism, it impacts communities and democracies in really serious, significant ways. And so you can imagine that if this process has suddenly been accelerated in the last month, at exactly the moment when we most urgently need local news, there's going to be an impact on coverage. It's impossible for there not to be.
Kristen, I want to dig into this dichotomy a little bit of, you know, newsrooms on a national level doing relatively well, the New York Times being a great example, and the polling that shows the majority of Americans approve of the media's job right now. And yet, people saying, oh, I hit a paywall on my local news site, or, oh, I don't subscribe to, you know, the newspaper in my city. Is there a way to bridge that gap and motivate people to support local outlets now?
I think we're starting to see that now. There are a number of funds out there, people raising money for laid off and furloughed journalists. But along with that trust that people say, there was a report, I think it was last year from Pew, that said 71% of people thought that local news was doing well financially. Mm-hmm. The dichotomy is that national newsrooms, particularly the New York Times, the Washington Post, have figured out how to switch their business model over to ask to get paid for what they produce. And what we're seeing more and more is local newsrooms making the case that we're bringing you something of value and that you should pay for it. And, you know, setting up paywalls that are dynamic that say, okay, you, this kind of reader will read three pieces before they have an opportunity to subscribe. But the other trick to this, and I see this as the biggest problem for really small, independently owned places, even those that are online only and have existed in the last 10 years, is we have to get the technology right. We have more sophisticated news consumers than we ever have before, thanks to our tech giants, right, who have made everything really easy to use. So if you're a news consumer and you want to open up your local news site to read a story and you're hit with wonky ads that don't open and pop-up videos, you're going to flip off really quickly. So we have to make the product is worth paying for. The news itself is worth paying for. We have to make platforms for our consumers that are also worth paying for.
I mean, one thing that happens when you have, you know, paywalls up everywhere is the fracturing of the media landscape, so that people suddenly now have to go to 10 different places and pay 10 different fees in order to try to access different kinds of reporting. A lot of local news outlets in the last few weeks have actually put down, temporarily lowered their paywalls for coronavirus coverage because they want to do the right thing. But that raises the issue that if, you know, all journalism, if you have to pay for all journalism, that's going to leave folks who are in financial straits or who are poor or marginalized in some way out in the cold. And so I do think it's worth us, you know, we've been making the case at Penn for the last year, and so have many others, that local journalism is a public good. It is a service that is so vital to society that it's worth more than the kind of ticket price, right, or the amount that people have to pay for it, that it has larger impact and larger benefits for society.
Victoria, one thing I wanted to have you elaborate on is this call for potentially federal funds to support journalism right now. Can you elaborate what Penn, your organization, is asking for and whether that poses any weird ethical dilemmas? After all, you know, we all report on government all the time.
Despite the fact that they may receive some funding from the government as well as funding from other sources, I think it's really important to have some context there. First of all, the U.S. government has actually supported journalism in this country since it was founded in the form of postal subsidies, tax breaks, government ads, and from the 1960s onward through direct funding through the Corporation Public Broadcasting.
We are having this conversation on public radio, after all, yes.
Exactly. But second of all, those countries that rank highest on press freedom indices around the world, democracies like Norway, Sweden, the Netherlands, and Belgium, are also have the highest rates of public funding for local journalism. So there are clearly ways that we can set these mechanisms up, which we already have done in this country, that protect editorial independence while providing funds. It's just a question of will and way. And I do think that that point that Kristen made earlier, that 70% of the American public don't realize that local outlets are in trouble, I hope and I think that that is changing, that we are kind of in this moment where there's an awakening of the need to support local journalism.
Kristen, I'm going to give you the last word here. Are there any bright spots that you are watching right now where you think, yes, that model is going to help, or yes, this thing is going to work both in the pandemic and after?
It's the relationships that local newsrooms, regardless of what they look like, have built with their communities. So places like Berkeleyside, which raised $1 million in a direct public offering previously, you know, are able to reach out to their community and tell them what's happening and get support. I see here in Tampa Bay people speaking out in favor of the Tampa Bay Times. It's a fuzzy thing, but that relationship is what makes local journalism unlike anything else. And the beat reporters who can now work from home because they've had relationships with people and institutions are why we know what's happening in government and hospitals and schools and all of the things that impact our lives. So I'm hopeful that those relationships will be one of the key things that pulls us through. And one of the places that it matters most is with our communities, and that those communities understand we need them just as much as they need us.
Kristen Hare covers local news for the journalism nonprofit Pointer, and Victoria Vilk is Program Director of Digital Safety and Free Expression at Pan America. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you so much.
We just heard about the hit local media has taken as a result of COVID-19 after years of ongoing struggles. One of the many reasons this could be a big problem is that news and social media are changing the way we learn about and track the spread of infectious diseases. Everything from the reports published on your local news sites to the tweets you send, those are all digital breadcrumbs that epidemiologists use to follow public health patterns and even crowdsource the disease hunting process. One of the websites at the center of so-called digital epidemiology is ProMed, a mostly volunteer-run program of the International Society for Infectious Diseases.
We basically scour what's out there using both formal information sources as well as non-formal information sources to identify early the onset of potential outbreaks of concern.
That's Dr. Marjorie Pollack, a physician, medical epidemiologist, and deputy editor of ProMed. She says their electronic database and listserv are freely available to anyone in the world. ProMed relies on expert moderators like Dr. Pollack to vet information on the web, as well as a pool of 80,000 subscribers worldwide to alert them to disease trends in their region. That's how Dr. Pollack first learned about a potential new disease outbreak on the night of December 30th in 2019.
We got an email, actually, from colleagues in Taiwan alerting us to a Weibo posting. Weibo is the Chinese social media platform. It was alerting us to an announcement from the Wuhan Health Commission that there was a cluster of cases of atypical pneumonia in a hospital.
The email contained a photo of a notice of several cases of pneumonia with unknown origins. Dr. Pollack and her team quickly moved to verify the source of the alert and the off chance that it had been doctored.
So we searched looking for collateral, separate source verifying what was going on, and found the Sina Financial Business News had actually followed up on it, had called the Wuhan Health Commission, and they had an article where they verified that it was real.
And so, just before midnight, Dr. Pollack hit send on a ProMed email titled Undiagnosed Pneumonia, alerting the international community to what we now know as COVID-19. I asked Dr. Pollack what was going through her mind when she first saw the signs of a new infectious disease.
Having been involved with the SARS outbreak back in 2003, an alarm bell went off. It was very, very much a deja vu of when the first reports came out of Guangdong on SARS in 2003.
Broadly speaking, when you are trying to figure out kind of whether a new disease is emerging, how do you and other epidemiologists use local news and social media to get snippets of information? And I guess, how important are those things in gathering information for you?
Very important. We use all different sources of information. ProMed began in 1994 as an offshoot of a 1991 Institute of Medicine meeting and report on disease surveillance, pointing out that there were significant shortcomings to the disease surveillance for picking up emerging diseases. In those days, the internet was in its nascence in terms of widespread use. And it was started with a focus on seeing if the internet could help provide sources of information faster. What we found early on was that local media oftentimes were the first to get reports out. The official process involves doing an investigation, confirming before information was released in those days. It has changed. And nowadays, unofficial reports as a signal something is going on are coming out as early warnings and early alerts.
When you're thinking about social media, local news, just things you see on the internet, that's a lot of information and just sort of a high volume of data. How do you sift through that and make sense of what you're seeing and find patterns?
It's a challenge. We have an account where we have access to all Twitter feeds globally in all languages. And it pushes alerts to us in the form of individual emails. What transpired as COVID was picking up in terms of more awareness around the world and more countries getting involved, the volume of incoming reports logarithmically increased to the point of getting over 1,500 email alerts per day.
Wow.
Had to set up a separate new email account just for that. You get to a point almost on one level of information overload. That's where you really do very much need the help of information aggregators, the computer doing it, because the manual ability just gets surpassed.
How do you vet that information and know what's solid?
Look for other sources of information. You get to know reliable sources, reliable journalists. You know who you can trust, who has a secondary agenda, you know. You do have to be careful about opposition parties and countries trying to embarrass governments and a lot of peripheral things going on that can get in the way. You do start to know what's reliable, who's reliable globally. But that being said, there are new sources that come up, and you look to verify it. You look to see who's covering it. I know sometimes I'll see a report from a source I may not know, but then I see it's been replicated on sources that are not on the list of high reliability.
When you think about how this kind of work is going to be done in the future, how do you think social media and other communications platforms are going to change the way we learn about public health issues, you know, as we move forward into this century?
They already have. I think it will continue to evolve. I don't have a crystal ball to predict what's next on the horizon, but I strongly suspect that there will be new innovations and there will be excellent people on the computational epidemiology side who are working on trying to harness this information and capture it and get it out sooner. I don't think it will eliminate the human need. I don't think we're at the point where the computers have total intelligence the same way humans do for picking up or getting a gut reaction that this may be something.
Marjorie Pollack is a physician, epidemiologist, and the deputy editor of ProMed. Dr. Pollack, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
All right, that's our show for today. With everything going on, we appreciate you being with us. You can also listen to all our COVID-19 coverage at thetakeaway.org/coronavirus. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at thetakeaway. I'm at Lizzie O'Reilly. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.